Welcome to episode 4 of Who Do You Think You Are? A podcast about the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. Each episode, we start by reading one of Dave's remixes of an old koan, which is essentially an old Chinese story. And that leads to a discussion about all sorts of stuff, from spirituality to politics to gender to social media to art. We usually have a guest, and this week we have two. Brooklyn Caldwell Gatewood, a new friend of ours in LA who's been writing poetry since she was a child and who actually has a TED Talk about listening like a poet. Find that and more about her at her website, theartofhonesty.com. Our other guest,
India Brookover, good friend of mine, and she recently spent a week at Deer Park Monastery talking about a lot of issues around consent and gender issues within Buddhism and in organizations. And so I really want to get her viewpoint on this story. And so we invited her, and she's been so gracious to come along at the last minute and join us. So thank you for coming.
Oh, no problem.
Also this week, we've started a new feature, which is that we ask for poetry submissions of work that relates with the current episode's story. We chose three this time, three poems from the submissions, and you'll hear those in the episode, along with a poem by Brooking. Find more information about all of this by clicking our links, and please submit poetry for the next one if you're interested.
Here's a story. Years ago, when I was a novice monk, I was visiting the monastery of a well-known Zen teacher and noticed that he allowed a young female student to stay alone in his private quarters with him. She has since gone on to become a well-known nun and teacher herself, but I won't use either of their names since I did not ask their permission to tell this story. I found the arrangement questionable, especially since the rules of the monastery forbid women from being alone with the monks. I asked the teacher about it, and he just said,
"She's a great student."
He could see I was still skeptical, so he suggested I meet with her myself.
Do you want to have a spiritual talk or a practical one?
Spiritual.
Let me go prepare myself, and then come meet me alone.
She went into her room for a few minutes, then called for me to come in.
Close the door.
I found her lying on the bed naked, with her legs open. Unfazed, I pointed between her legs and said, "What's in there?"
"That's where every Buddha, monk, and nun come from."
"And may I enter?"
"Those who understand what they want, do what they want."
I searched for a response, but there was nothing to say.
"If you're satisfied, you can leave."
I left quickly. The teacher saw me on my way out and said,
"I assume you got what you wanted? I told you she's a great student." India, what was your general impression when you first read this story?
I don't like this story.
This is why I invited you on.
Oh my god. I had just spent a week at a monastery in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh. And they're a little bit more conservative in that tradition, in the sense that monks and nuns, people who take vows, are celibate, and they live separately, except for a few days a week. And when you stay, you're not allowed to stay with the opposite gender. Interestingly, unless you're in a family, which I was kind of like, first, like, what's going on here? And then I kind of realized it's more about, like, the capacity. Like, there's just more dorms, I think, in the month's quarters. In the wake of the Me Too movement and some things that have come up in a community I participate in, I had a lot of questions for practitioners, especially monks and nuns and other lay people who practice more intensely than I do, about issues of consent and boundaries. And one thing that came up during this trip that I thought was so funny and cool was I was talking to one of the nuns, not really about consent or anything, but she was talking about the theme for the next teen camp, and she said, oh yeah, the next teen camp, I think it's going to be strong boundaries, not walls. And then I thought that was kind of cool, especially for teens right now, and sort of what are issues of consent, and also what are issues of just being open with other people and trust. And it was interesting being in a space where, you know, they are so much more conservative out in the real world, and also sort of coming there as a feminist and knowing that a lot of the nuns are very much feminists themselves, but do really honor and live by this sort of code of purity, and sort of grappling with that. So anyway, when I read the story, just seeing the story of that, sorry, I'm not very articulate right now, but just seeing that, especially written from a man's perspective, and knowing sort of that it was written with sort of a very contemporary feminist spin, I just thought of all of the nuns I had just spent time with and sort of their commitment. I think what's really struck me with them, I didn't come back deciding to become a nun and be celibate or whatever, but I just really, like, admired their sense of their own protection of their own body and honoring their own body. And a lot of that tradition is, regardless of sexuality, is about taking care of yourself and taking care of your body. And that's probably one of the three most important parts of the entire tradition. And then so seeing this story sort of written that was supposed to be very wry, I guess, and it's based on, as I understand it, it's based on a very old koan. And can I say that about it was originally based on someone who exists?
Right, no, I'll give some background on it. So the original story is from the 12th century. It was about a nun named Miaozong originally. I can name her because she's long dead. Nobody cares, I think. But
you don't know.
It was printed with her name in it in her biography, so I assume that's all been worked out by now. But so she was a very respected elderly nun by the time she was famous, and so the intent of the piece at the time was to really. These were often propaganda pieces for the teachers named in them, and so it was a way of showing her power as a teacher, supposedly, and using an elderly respected nun as the young female in the story. I was intentionally supposed to be, you know, a hit. It was supposed to trigger you, was the intent. So yeah, that's all I think I'll say about
that. Can you say anything about the way that koan spun? You said it, like, used a line that was kind of an established line and kind of...
Oh yeah, so just some context for that. There's the one line at the end, those who understand what they want, do what they want. Originally... that line was horses, because the original story, I should say, is almost, it's pretty much exactly what happens in the way I wrote it. Like, everything, all the nakedness and the sexual suggestion is in the original story exactly like that. The only difference is her line was, horses may cross, asses may not, is what she said, which sounds like a complete non sequitur. But that was a reference to an old line of an older master who had said, that was a man who had said, I am a bridge that both horses and asses may cross. So both the stupid and the noble, the wise, and anybody can use me to find the truth through my teaching. And she was saying, I think there's a lot of nuance to how she was saying that. I'm sorry, but here, horses may cross, but asses aren't gonna get this. And I took that as a critique of especially of the time, but I don't know how much we think has changed in that way, but of... the view that men held of women, that a man wasn't going to be able to see the truth through a woman the way he could through a man. I always got a twinge of sadness the way she did that. Like, almost, I'm sorry, but if you can't get this, you can't get this, and I can't help you. And that really struck me, the power in that. And I worked forever on how to retranslate that line for the modern so it could in any way hit what you meant to say without us knowing who Joshua was, the original master. And I reread it like 18 to 25 to 40 times until I feel like I boiled down what she was actually trying to say in a way. Basically, the ignorant aren't going to get it. If you went, yeah, I don't know, there's a lot more to that line we can get into later, but that's the gist of it.
So I guess my take on it was, well, I don't know how much we want to get into. The story's a little bit watered down from the original version that I read in terms of, it wasn't more sexually explicit, it just used existing characters that, and I had said to Dave, do not publish this with the characters that you use. It's not okay.
Which is, again, why I want to have you on. I'll talk more about that, too. So originally, I don't want to put it in print. Even my teacher, Brad, agreed we shouldn't put those names in print because people will just Google the teacher I named and see the story and be like, oh, this actually happened. So we decided not to do that. But what happened was the story was originally written. Indy actually was telling me about Thich Nhat Hanh, mm-hmm. and he has a companion nun, and they spend a lot of time in close quarters. And my first thought when she told me that was, oh, and I kind of raised an eyebrow, like, oh, does he have a companion? You know, and then I realized, you know, having already heard the story before, I was being that priest. I was being the judgmental person questioning somebody else's relationships and their vows and what they're doing with their personal selves. So I wanted to use Thich Nhat Hanh's name originally, but we decided that was inappropriate. Also, as India informed me, using that nun's name without consent would be, I don't know.
Using anybody's name, I think putting somebody in a story and talking about their body without their consent is not okay at all. But after, and I honestly don't think nuns are more special than anyone else when it comes to consent, but after spending a week with nuns who had taken a vow of celibacy talking about consent, I was especially just like, holy shit, this is so bad. This is so wrong.
So at first your main problem was just like the specific names.
It's compounded.
Right.
I wouldn't want to see a story about any existing person mentioning them displaying their genitalia unless they were like enthusiastically like, yes, publish this about me.
Enthusiastic consent, you're saying?
Enthusiastic consent.
This is an interesting angle on consent, because it's sort of like There was an act, and the thing that stuck out most to me in the story is that she's a student, because I read it as that was an act of a teacher, and that was an act of somebody who was fully empowered in their knowing and their expression and their teaching.
You said an act of somebody who was fully empowered?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As the female, the nun. And yet, this piece about, okay, well, what happens in the aftermath of that, and is there some sort of objectification in the realm of story? And I wasn't really thinking about it at that level. I was thinking about it at the level of, why are we calling her a student? And that sort of took me into this portal around power and authority and how we regard females in lineage, especially Zen. And I could go on about that. I see you nodding your head.
No, we're aware. This is what I wanted, yes. Matthew, what were your impressions?
Well, with, I guess the line that I was the most kind of puzzled by in a way was, those who understand what they want do what they want. Because for me, I guess I'm left wondering, like, does the monk hear her say what she says and then just immediately leave? Or did a sexual encounter happen between them before he left?
That's an interesting question. I never even considered that somebody would think that they had an encounter, but actually I almost like that, because I feel like part of the point is, because almost like with her relationship with the teacher, that's not the point. If that's what you're worried about, you're missing everything that we're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess in the story too, if they did it or not, I would feel like it's besides the point.
Okay.
Especially in terms of that line.
Sure. What do you guys make of, or, well, I guess I'll ask, you know, anybody who wants to respond. What do you make of those who understand what they want, do what they want? What is she trying to say by that?
There was another version you read that... Can I speak to that one?
Yeah, sure.
I forget exactly what it was, but it was something like, if you think you can get to heaven with a sword.
Oh, that's the version that I read.
Yeah, India hated that version.
Well, I mean, I hate it all.
I love it. I like that.
You like that line.
That line to me is like, it's clearer. Because to me, like, when I hear that line, I'm like, okay, so she's saying, if you think you're sort of penetrating... desire is gonna get you where you want to go, then do what you want. And she's sort of, to me, it's almost an invitation of like, if you're that deluded, go ahead and be deluded and willing, like, and willingly letting herself be violated as a result of that. And then there's, again, there's this whole interesting conversation around power and where is the power when there's quote unquote violation, when it is framed in that way.
Are you saying that like that level of submission that willingly isn't actually a violation, or
potentially,
yeah, like mm-hmm. gives her the power because, in a way,
yes,
yeah.
I mean, if he asks for consent, and her response mm-hmm. is itself,
if you're that stupid, then by all means,
which is a very interesting way to respond. Mm-hmm. But then when I read those who know what they want, who understand what they want, do what they want. To me, that has a little bit of a different twist to it, mm-hmm. and it could kind of go multiple ways, and maybe that's why you chose that version, because it's more ambiguous?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Dave, can you say anything about your intention behind that line?
Yeah, I have a lot of... I was actually really happy when I finally got to that line, because I feel like it said so much more of what I meant to say. Although I lost the sword penis joke, which I did appreciate in the first one, because they're always supposed to be witty banters, and that was wittier. But we lost that. But, I don't know, Jung, I was told, has this idea that until you can see your subconscious consciously, you do not possess free will.
It's exactly the other piece I was feeling in it, around like making shadow so explicit as part of what the teaching was.
Yeah, and almost mm-hmm. if he wants to have deluded sex, because these are all Buddhist monks, right? So I feel like she's assuming that the monks are all doing the same kind of training towards... you know, enlightenment or the truth. We're all here for the same reason. And so, yeah, you can embrace your shadow side, but if you do it willingly, I mean, I guess the old thing is the karma doesn't stick is the idea. But, yeah, I mean, I really, when I think about just the word consent bothers me, it rings so much like tolerance. Used to, when people are like, what we need in this country is more tolerance for each other. And I'm like, really? That's what we're shooting for as a country, as a people, is like to be able to tolerate each other's presence? Like, that's such a low, mundane, sad bar. Yeah. And I feel like if our sexual culture is kind of the point where, like, we're shooting for consent, I don't want to have consensual sex. That sounds depressing and just, I mean, that sounded horrible. I do want to have only consensual sex. Let me take that back. I don't want to have merely consensual sex.
You want enthusiastically consensual sex.
Not even consensual. I want to have enthusiastically wanting sex. That's actually the only sex I want to have.
Desired sex.
I don't want to take anything for anybody. To me, like, the whole idea that you can ever take what you want is a complete delusion. If you think that you can get happiness by taking something, then you don't, then you're never going to get happiness. You're never going to get what you want. All you're going to get is more wanting, more desire. I mean, what Buddhism teaches and what Zen teaches is that if you really understand who you are and what your desires are, every action you do in that understanding is compassionate action, is what you truly want, which is what everything wants, which mm-hmm. is the truth, which is enlightened action. You know, it's... the understanding that I can't do anything to you, I'm not doing to myself. I've heard some people compare true compassion to sex, and I love this, they were explicitly saying good sex, as in the thing that gives you the most pleasure is what gives somebody else the most pleasure, just intrinsically. You're not trying to do a nice thing for somebody, you're not trying to take something from somebody, you're doing what you want, and it's exactly the thing the other person wants the most, and that's what true compassion and enlightened action is. But I guess what she's trying to point out to him.
So... India, what? Who do you think has the power in the story?
Hold on, let me look at it.
Okay.
I mean, nobody? Hold on.
I'm pretty sure she would have been clothed if it was a practical talk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where every Buddha...
And what would she have said if it was a practical talk?
They would have had tea, you know?
Like, yeah.
It would have looked like what we think spiritual is.
Yeah. 5,000.
I don't know. I don't see anyone having power in this situation.
That's interesting to me.
How do you not see her as having power? It's so... such raw power.
I feel that too, and that's why I'm so curious about her, you know, why she doesn't like it.
Well, okay, I have this thing. I've ranted to Dave about vagina feminism before, and, like... Like, I'm kind of sick of, you know, the feminism in the sense that, like, the source of women's power is their, like, inherent femaleness. Mm-hmm. I'm so sick of that. I'm like, can a vagina and a penis just be organs? Like, is that so unspiritual? Or is that so, like, it's when she's trying to prove her point by, like, showing him, like, that's where every Buddha, monk, and nun came from. It's like, well, any woman could do the same thing. Like, how is that power?
So I feel like what you're saying is that it's objectifying the vagina by making it this, like, spiritual metaphor instead of just being somebody else's body.
Yes. And I think that there's kind of, and I'm saying, or any cisgendered woman or any woman who has a vagina. But, it's kind of like one time a friend of mine, I don't want to say something stupid and have it be on the internet, but.
I can't Google it, it's audio.
Okay. it's sort of like when I hear about women's reproductive systems being sort of put on this pedestal as this, like, inherently spiritual thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, what about my brain? Like, what about me as a person, like, beyond my gender? You know? And it's like, I don't feel like I'm inherently a portal to the universe. Just, or, like, a portal to God, or, like, how people sort of make that. And I guess it's like, frustrated me about this story is there's so few koans that feature women, and the first one we're gonna use, as I get the feminism of it, like, I'm not like, I know I sound very like not sex positive right now, but like but like I get the feminism of it, but it's like of the stories of the women featured in Coen's, we're going with the first one we're gonna use is the one where she's like literally like displaying her badge. Mm-hmm. Like there's so much more to being a woman than asserting your power through your reproductive capability.
No, I hear that.
And
can I ask you, if you don't mind, after we had that conversation, I asked you, if you're comfortable with the story, and you said you asked two teachers about it, and one of them thought it was fine, one of them was severely an objection. Do you want to talk about that at all? Like, what the objections were of...
It was somewhat similar to what India is saying, that it's poor timing in the world right now, and I do think there's something about... And actually, let's see if I can articulate this. One of her points was about the timing. One of it was about don't name a specific teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And... I think those were the main pieces, and there are more powerful messages that you could share. But the more I'm sitting with it, and I was worried about doing this podcast because I was like, God, I don't know what to say about this. This is a koan. I'm just sort of blankly sitting with it for weeks now.
That's how you do a koan.
But as we're in the conversation, it's like these layers are opening up, and I don't know how to articulate this, but I just start with my own personal story. So as a woman, I hate doing the identity politics thing, but I'm doing it right now. As a woman on my own spiritual path, I started in Zen and I hated it. Mm-hmm. And my immediate response was like, okay, maybe this is my ego just not wanting to get up at 5 a.m. and meditate. But there was something else going on for me that was like, this is designed for men. I'm pretty sure this entire mm-hmm. tradition is mm-hmm. designed for the male psyche. And that was just this instinct I had for years. And then finally, I moved to Berkeley and used to go to the Berkeley Zen Center, and I saw this poster, and there was this woman practitioner coming to do a day long for women only, and she was a female Zen historian on the history of women in Zen, and I was like, oh, I have to go. So I go have this day long with this woman, and it confirmed all my suspicions that that there's this whole history, and you'll have to forgive me, anybody who's listening who's an expert on this, because I might get some of the details wrong, because this is years ago at this point. But the gist of it was, like in almost every spiritual tradition in human history, the feminine aspect of the practice, A, is less institutionalized and codified, mm-hmm. because the feminine practice by nature tends to be more embodied, and there's less of a drive to institutionalize in the feminine or female psyche, I think you could argue. And then whenever there was a practice field, half the time they would get burned down. There was something so fundamentally threatening about mm-hmm. the feminine awakening that, like, women in Zen were in hiding for a really long time, and their monasteries were burned down, and, like, these stories exist in every tradition around the world. So there's this sort of clandestine quality to feminine practice. And she was talking about how the feminine practice had more of a verbal element, more of a body element to it. So there's something for me here in this particular story that I actually do find very powerful. And you can feel that it is sort of embedded in an acceptable form for the times. Just like if you go back to the Gnostic Gospels, mm-hmm. which most people don't read because they're very countercultural to mainstream Christianity, but there's these Gospels of Mary. And if you even trace the lineage of the different Gospels of Mary, they get changed over time to fit better in patriarchal culture. But she actually, many would say, had the clearest direct transmissions of Jesus's teachings. Mm-hmm. And in her words, they were the strongest, and then they get changed over time. So in this story, I feel this element where she's calling that out, and she's using the power I'm just going to speak in gender, and let's caveat that I know that this is generalizations, but that she's recognizing the power of the female body. She's using it to lure the male in. He takes the bait, and he's like, "Can I enter?" Mm-hmm. And then the response is like she's showing him the blind spot in his own spiritual path in a way that only such a direct teaching can. So I interpret it as direct teaching that was somehow able to penetrate, ironically, through the cultural bullshit of the time. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, I consider it a very empowering story. In the current cultural context, without like all those layers, it's of course also risky and can be perceived as the exact opposite.
So. Because of the perception of submission involved in her action?
Yeah, I think India's articulating a lot of those points really well, just in terms of like the way we tend to objectify genitalia and all those things. But at the end of the day, for me, I'm kind of more thumbs up than thumbs down with a lot of context.
I think what struck me so much about it, one reason I like it so much is, you know, outside of gender politics, but I feel like in a way that I'm not comfortable speaking to, it might play into the current conversation. But I feel like the willingness to, one thing I was taught a lot in my training was that a large part of the practice path becomes a willingness to lay yourself down and to lose in certain things. Especially if you're doing counseling, if you're doing spiritual work with anybody, the willingness to, I was told it was a power under technique, is sometimes the most powerful tool you have, especially when working with people. I think the most clear example that's similar I can think of is that story from Les Mis, where the, and I don't like making sex like this, I'm really nervous about this analogy, but I still think it works. The priest is letting Jean Valjean stay with him for a while, right when he's fresh out of prison, and in the middle of the night, Jean Valjean steals a couple of candlesticks and flees, silver candlesticks, and the police catch him, and they bring him back to the church, and they say, "We caught this guy who stole your candlesticks. Will you, what do you want to do? What do you want us to do with him?" And the priest says, no, I gave those to him. I let him have those." And the cop's like, "Are you sure?" He's like, "Yeah, no, give those to him. Nothing happens to him." And so, and then after the cop leaves, he's just like, "I just bought your soul for God now. No good is done good with your life." I just like that power to, the power to lose, I feel like is ultimate power. Like if you don't have to win, if you don't have to be dominant, then you're really free, and in a way in the world, you're not just liberated, but actually ultimately powerful. When you don't, I guess, yeah, when you're able to go either way, if that makes sense. That's what struck me. I've had teachers do that, and I've had recently, this last year, last couple of years, a woman professor who I highly, highly respect, who often did that. And the funny thing was, for me, if we were arguing, I could see that she was baiting me into you know, getting into a more forceful, aggressive argument, where I might even be winning, just to show me what winning felt like for me and why I had to have that need. Like, that to me was like, wow, you really, that's true mastery. That's personal mastery and also, like, social situational, that's mastery. So, yeah, that's a lot of what.
So she was using that as a teaching tool. And then through that process, what did you learn about?
I learned, yeah, the desire mind, the hindered mind, I guess, that is that need to win, to conquer, to dominate, to even not be oppressed. Because sometimes some of the lessons were things where, and I can't tell how much she was really being intentional with this, but where she was arguing a losing side that she might very well have known was losing, just to watch me get angry, to watch me feel the need to prove a point, even if I was right, but that feeling, right or wrong, that was just pure desire on my part that's completely leading back into my own suffering.
So
you know?
She was trolling you.
Yeah, basically. With a kind conversation afterwards, be like, now, how did you feel and what happened for you and what was that for?
Yeah, I guess... I see, I guess I'm just, it's, I'm reading this from just such a modern point of view in the sense where, like, we all get that she has the power because every Buddha, monk, and nun comes from her vagina. Like, we get that. Mm-hmm. Like, what's next?
Mm-hmm. I'm with you there. Because, I mean, really, Matthew could point to his penis and say, everything came from here, too,
yeah.
Right? No, that's, I'm with you there.
It's just,
well, what is
or
next?
Probably his balls, I don't know, that'd be more appropriate.
Okay, so woman more than body, woman also brain. Mm-hmm. What is the ask? What is the...
Well, I mean, at this moment in history, in Buddhism all over the world, there's so much sexual assault going on in Western Buddhism and Eastern Buddhism, and, you know, it's... And as in every institution, you know, so... We still can't get past this concept of genitalia, and we need, and it's like the concept of like who's in power, and we're still talking about power in the context of reproductive systems, you know. It's like, I don't know how you could tell this story. I mean, maybe it would be more boring, but a story just about her power as just being an administrator or, like, the teacher or a boss or, like, you know, and so I guess that's what's next, and it's not as exciting as sex. Yeah, so I guess I'm coming out, I'm sounding like a huge prude on this podcast, but, like, that's sort of, I guess, where I'm at.
What do you think about that? You asked, like, well, what's next? You know, and I am curious about that. What?
Yeah, well, I mean, this sort of, I put a different hat on here because my profession is in working with groups on collaborative leadership. So a question I sit with most days is, okay, so we're moving beyond patriarchy. But one of the reasons we're not actually moving beyond patriarchy is because we don't have a vision of what a different approach to leadership looks like. And I personally do not in any way, shape, or form believe it's just give women the same role. Mm. Like, there, we need to have a fundamental paradigm shift in the way we conceptualize leadership. And so, to me, it's like, there's something else. There actually is a power in feminine ways of knowing and feminine ways of sense making and feminine ways of listening for right action that is much more interesting to me than just handing the baton or handing the penis, let's just say, to a woman, you know? So, and I think our whole planet is asking that question right now, and that's one of the most interesting questions around to me, but I don't have an answer. And I think that's part of the nature of this shift is no individual person has the answer. Mm-hmm. But so how do we sort of feel our way forward together in a new way?
Well, I love what you just said, because from a, not just about this civil rights issue, whatever you want to call it, the proper words for different issues are, but if you think about what patriarchy is, it's not just about patriarchy. The entire world and society, social structure we understand has been built up either by or alongside. And the whole reason that feminism would even come into being is because there's a much larger ground shift happening, which is our whole understanding of hierarchy and dominance and competition and what it means to be human and struggle and survive, that's shifting. And I feel like all civil rights struggles are a part of that shift. And the fact that we're even having them in the last century, the last few centuries, is incredible. It shows that as humans, we're doing something wholly brand new, which is maybe we want to find a more holistic, universal understanding of ourselves and how we relate to each other. And so, yeah, you're right. We have no idea what that's going to look like. And I just love contemplating that cliff. And I do think it's often missing from, like you're saying, from the conversation. It's not about giving any one group more power to act like the dominant group may have been acting for the last 5,000 years.
Yeah, then you're just shifting
right?
Victim, yeah. Perpetrator, and we're in a new cycle.
And on small-scale levels, I've seen some groups, you know, do that, and it feels like we're still just doing the same hierarchies. You guys are just with different people on in top.
It's Animal Farm.
Yeah, exactly. I've seen that happen. It's really depressing. Yeah. Part of why I gave up on activism in some ways, because I found a lot of what... Yeah, activism kind of had no post-game plan, which is what you see most revolutions in history, is there's no post-game plan, and then what they do is rebuild the same structure again, and it's a little disheartening.
But I think, I guess where I was coming at it from was not, like, you know, like, creating a matriarchy as like, a reverse reflection of, like, a patriarchy in more of a sense of just, like, putting women at the table. But... No, I really like what you were saying, though, about this paradigm shift, and it's kind of sad that I can't really imagine.
I don't know if any of us have a template. Yeah, that's what's kind of exciting about it. But I get sad when I see the conversation so focused on what you were just saying, just like, we need what they have, and then it's less creative than it could be.
I mean, my whole opinion on being a white man... is that...
What is that?
No,
it's just a small aside.
Let me tell you. She's never heard what it's like to be a white man. I can mansplain being a man. It's the one thing I'm allowed to mansplain, right? Is being a man.
Yeah,
can I have this one?
Okay.
I know. And I was playing with a joke. It was a good joke. as far as I understand masculinity and dominance, and again, I'm a 5'2" man. I'm not the best at masculinity and dominance. But... dominance and power aren't that fun. If you actually kind of like, back to that line, like if you understand what you want, if you know what power is, and the Tao says this all the time too, you don't want power. Power is burden, power is responsibility. I feel like people forget this a lot, that if you're not doing it for personal gain, which again, if you study your own personal gain long enough, you realize it's not going to make you happy either. There's no benefit except the people are relying on you, and usually, you know, my experiences with being a boss and being in leadership positions was very disheartening because, you know, coming up as an anarchist activist, I always thought if we get ourselves in power or if we take away the power structure, people will rise up and be their best selves. My experience as a boss trying to cultivate that was that when people see a leader, they are more than willing to give you their agency because it's easier, because we all want to rely on something else has this under control. No, I feel like most people really don't understand what it means to take responsibility for their own lives. And the burden of leadership, at least to me, has been having to bear that burden for people. And that is not healthy.
No.
And it's not good. And I don't feel like anybody else should want that.
I think though, the kind of power that's talked about in terms of flipping the paradigm is not being the boss, but the sort of invisible power... So I'm about to mansplain being a man to you. But
please do. Femsplain? No, we have a word
for
that.
Yeah, femsplain. I think there's a power that you're not acknowledging in the sense of, you know, and I'm not saying you as a person, just
thank you for
the
clarifying.
Dominant, whoever, whatever gender or race or religion or whatever is in the dominant class, that, you know, you don't have to worry about things that people who are not in power have to worry about, you know, in terms of being safe or economics or being taken seriously or, you know, or walking down the street at night. And that's such a cliche, but it's true. And I think, so there's two different kinds of powers. There's the like acknowledged power, the conscious power you have when you're in a position of power and you're a boss and you see your responsibilities play out and people look up to you and, there's that sort of system, but then there's also the invisible power that it's kind of like the whole concept of the fish in water. The fish doesn't know that it's surrounded by water.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to be careful to see, okay, so what kind of power structures are we trying to change? Because there are a lot of burdens of being the boss, or burdens of being on top, and it's lonely on top.
On his limit, to me, to be an aware person on top at all, everything you just described, at least, that becomes your burden too. But almost in a way that you can't even do anything about, but it also is your responsibility to try. Like, everybody's suffering because is your responsibility, is what I'm saying.
Like, ultimately, leadership is listening.
Yeah, and it's a lot to listen to. I think that's why you get corrupt leaders, because you really just... It's hard for a human being to do that job well. I mean, technically, the people we have in power in this city or in this country are responsible. Most of them, if you ask them, probably do really care about all the issues you're talking about. Would love to fix them, I bet. If you took on a one-for-one conversation, I'm sure if there was a solution, they would fix those as soon as they could. I think most. I don't really know. I'm not going to speak for them. But I would hope so. But you can't. And I think that's where corruption comes from, is that you put these things on a human being and they can't handle it, because a human being can't actually fix those things. And it's hard. I mean, the amount of social... Like we're talking about, the amount of social structure that goes into creating patriarchy as it is beyond... Yeah, any one person's thing.
Yeah, so it seems like embedded in a lot of the stuff we're saying is that maybe the ideal would be, you know, less hierarchy, less dominance, less top-down, less vertical, and more horizontal, and more collaboration.
Mm-hmm. But not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, this is where, like, I would throw in the integral perspective is very helpful here.
Sure. 'Cause
if you... Just going to throw some lingo out there, but not explain it too much, but from a adult development perspective, the argument is that one of the leading cultural edges, they call it green meme and spiral dynamics, and if you Google that, you'll see a whole map, and I'm not going to try to explain it on an audio podcast, but that leading edge is, that's the recognition. It's like, okay, this hierarchy thing is not enough. Let's respond by focusing on the horizontal and the inclusiveness and the equality and the egalitarian, but that is also not enough, because then you have no vision. And some would argue, Ken Wilber just put out a book on this, that that's what got Trump elected, is that if you don't have a vision, then we go back to the last paradigm in which we did have something that looked like visionary leadership, even if it's a very distorted version of visionary leadership. It's clearer than some of what the very liberal left has been able to offer. And so it's like, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have to find a way to have like an integrated masculine feminine leadership model, or whatever language you want to throw at it, but something that gives us both direction and inclusion. And that's where I come back to that point where I feel like that's a cultural edge globally, which makes it exciting and a sort of imponderable question at the same time. So.
And then I guess that makes me feel, your expertise is way beyond anything that I look into at all. So I'm like learning a lot here. But I also feel cynical, like I like what you said about not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because I think in the end it's going to be an iterative thing, because I've seen so many like horizontal power structures fail.
Totally.
But maybe why they fail is because there's so little in such a, there's such outliers in this vertical society we have, you know. I guess we're just going to, I don't know, I think we're going to be going back and forth between these two paradigms. And I think that's probably what humanity has always been doing.
The oscillating.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think maybe we're just seeing an extreme version of that right now, or it's like amplified because of the internet, so we see more than we used to be able to see, or, you know.
I don't know if I can say this right or appropriately, but I almost feel like what we're asking, like, when I see horizontal things fail, my impression was that it was because people weren't personally empowered enough to be personally responsible enough to make it work. Kind of like watching, what was the movement? Occupy. Fail was mostly because what happened when you got in those meetings, every ego in the universe wanted to talk for a half hour about their opinions on things that didn't matter, and the whole thing fell apart, so nobody wanted to come back to the meetings because they were horrendous. that was my experience anyway. But so almost you need everybody to fully be empowered and responsible. So I feel like you're almost asking for the enlightened society, which is hard to do. But for in this situation, what I almost feel like needs to happen is those in power need to truly understand what who they are. Because those of us who were raised, in this culture, like man or woman, or just by family or whoever your upbringing was, you may have been raised to feel more empowered and more assertive or more in how to take leadership. And if you're raised with that, you really can't deny that's who you are and the skill set that you were given. I mean, so you have to fully realize what that means. If you were raised or grew up in such a thing that you feel victimized or oppressed, then you have to fully realize your victimization, fully realize your oppression for those two things to come back to working together in harmony. Like everything has to, I guess, enlighten itself where it already is, I guess is what I'm saying.
Come to the middle.
Yeah.
Find the middle way, the middle path.
Which is what I like about her action, because in a way, if it's a story about female victimization and the subjugation of sexuality in a lot of ways, I mean, she showed her true power and I think enlightenment by completely embracing that. She's like, I know how you see me, and for this moment, I will just completely be that if that's what's required right now. And I feel like that's like an ownership of victimization in such a way that's like so powerful.
That's what serves awakening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what serves awakening, I think, for somebody who feels that way, is to fully know themselves as victim, I guess.
Should we read a poem?
Yeah, let's move into poetry.
Who wants to go first?
I can read the one that I chose.
Yeah.
It's by Leah Clancy, and the poem is called "It's Gonna Happen When You Least Expect It." I am really so heartbroken, and the body I am in is past the point of feeling rejected. All I want you to acknowledge is that even though you probably will never love me, you'll think of me and realize that I was some kind of muse. The scissor kicks in and leaves sheaths of hair leaving the top of my body. I am most like a Greek marble statue, skin alabaster and clean. When I lie in bed on my side, there is sagging softness. My boobs droop, and I look towards the mirror, hoping to finally see something else completely. How can I get so zenned out that I don't have any feelings, and my brain is replaced with a giant blue bowl of dark red cherries? I'll spend an afternoon just plucking off the stems and trimming the flesh from the pit. I need some golden grease to saturate my fat, because baby, I'm so hungover for you.
Wow.
What do you think?
That's a nice poem. So wait, are these poems, I don't know the rules of this game, are these poems inspired by the story or by the last podcast you did? Or
no, we put up the story on the internet and said send us poems that relate to this in any way, shape, or form.
Okay,
and
that's
people
cool.
did. Which is awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. So we got some submissions and then we chose some.
I'm so hungover for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's Koan-ish.
Mm-hmm.
I like when poems end with that energy that sort of spins you a different direction than you were expecting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm spinning.
Why'd you choose that poem, Matthew?
Well, I feel like it had a lot of clarity, just I guess with the imagery, and I feel like it was very confident while still being troubled. And you know, I mean, honestly, it was just kind of more of a gut emotional reaction when I read it that made me like it. And I was hoping, you know, I think with all of these, it was whenever you get together with people and talk about a poem, like all sorts of stuff comes up that you didn't see at first. So I kind of just chose it to see what would happen, what kind of conversation would spring out of it, you know? But yeah, I guess I'm interested in the speaker's relationship with the you.
Yeah, I'm curious about, because I think I'm hearing her relationship to how she's being seen versus how she sees herself versus how she wants to see herself.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole transition gets really amorphous. Because when it says I was your muse, like my first gut instinct is to think that that's almost objectification, mm-hmm. like making the vagina spiritual again. It's mm-hmm. like, I mean, it sounds nice, but come on, I'm a whole human being here. But then I feel like she's looking, like, trying to see herself as the thing that was muse-worthy.
Yeah.
Mm. And then Fonska had the bowl of cherries, but then she's seeing things not quite, boobs not in the right place for that, and a little, and then hungover. Yes, that's a lot of interesting, conflicting things.
Yes. I think it speaks back to the concept of being seen as a human. The feminism of being seen as beyond being a woman versus the feminism of being admired for your womanness.
But then the vulnerability plays so interestingly in there too, because it's not so...
It's not clear.
Yeah, it's not so black and white that see me as this beautiful human, not the beautiful person you think I am. See me as a beautiful human, but wait, am I? That, like, that's really interesting. That's, like, so human to me.
Yeah, and I think, like, the way... I mean, it's like... Women, I think, maybe, or maybe in just my experience, like, is it's like there is a little bit of being a woman, I think, maybe for men as well, of, like, wanting to be objectified a little bit. And it's, like, what's the balance of that with, you know, this of also wanting to be seen for who you are as a person.
And can we hold that paradox?
Yeah, can we hold that paradox in...
And I not guess, have rape culture.
Yeah, exactly.
And not have a Puritan, no desire allowed culture.
Exactly.
Either.
Exactly. And yeah. Yeah, I don't want to say every woman, but I think a lot of women do want to be thought of as a muse, but they also want to be loved. And that poem really touches on a lot.
Yeah, so when she says, I am most like a Greek marble statue when I lie on my bed on my side, so it's like, that's kind of an image of objectification, being like a statue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then she's like, dang, can I just get zenned out and not think about this for a while?
Yeah.
Because it's, I guess it's just so complex for her to try to navigate all these different...
Is it easier to be the Greek god statue when you're zenned out, I guess, when your mind isn't there to be a human anymore? I don't know. What'd you think?
I was really stuck with the cherries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. And it was interesting, too, because, like, what she called zenned out, and then the image of it was the classic feminine. Mm-hmm. Was, like, I was imagining, like, the grapes, and the Grecian goddess, and her belly, and her draping boobs. And
yeah.
And it's like, is that zen? Again, it's this, it's like this paradox of, I want to be seen for my mind, but I actually want to be worshipped for the goddess.
Yeah, exactly.
Very cat-like. It's very
changeable,
confusing, I imagine, for men.
Yes, it is.
It's a complex ask.
For women, too, but...
Yeah.
I guess it's one thing to experience it, well, to live it, and then...
To try to please all that, I would say, is a very delicate balance.
Yeah, it is.
One never knows if they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, and then it's different for every woman, so.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough for you guys.
Thanks for saying that. No one ever tells us how hard it is to be white men, all right? So thank you for finally admitting that.
That's a good transition to one of the poems I think I'll read.
Oh, wonderful.
Perfect.
Okay, so this one is speaking to the ask, so the line of the poem, or the Cohen story, where she says, where is it? A man, nope, just a person. Those who understand what they want do what they want. And I feel like, at least in sort of California culture, there's this ask of the masculine to be totally attuned at all times and totally present and in perfect integrity and able to read the wild, confusing paradox of the feminine. And, you know, there's this archetypal story of, like, the divine, wild feminine and the man that can, like, pin her down and with his presence, and, you know, this whole sort of archetypal sex act thing. And so this poem is sort of playing with that, and really it was a pissed off response to a man who was violating my heart. But really sort of taking that, it's called Kali, and taking that Kali energy. And so sometimes I feel almost embarrassed reading this one, and sometimes it feels just right. So, tearing the flesh off the bones of your false commitments, I gnaw through the skin I once so, so tenderly kissed, and shake my jaw back and forth to loosen the grip of that feebly flesh on that sexy bone that this wild beast still craves. Primal rage draws me step by predatory step, It stalks me as I stalk your heart, salivating at the scent of the pain I want you to acknowledge. And every inch your heart contracts, every clenching of your gut, every flinch is to me like the scent of blood to a tiger. I will rip your soul to shreds with this rage if you come near that way again, as a meek deer paralyzed with fear, masquerading as a man of integrity. So walk your man walk into the woods then, with your terrified nose held high. Walk into that great dark night that you claim calls you so. But be warned and wary in the night. Wild beasts are known to haunt those woods, and I hear that they prey with especially fierce delight on the bittersweet taste of men who lie to themselves.
I had somebody telling me recently, a woman that, on some level, this is what I was told, I reacted interestingly to this, but that on some level all women want to feel fear in their sexual desire, and all men want to feel conquest. And I did not like hearing that, because I don't feel like I want those things. And so hearing your poem was really gratifying, because I heard that conquest in with the kind of desire in the way that I think she was describing for men. And so it was just nice to hear you wanted to, I don't know. It's kind of like how in, back in kitchens, and I've heard in ancient Roman society too, the rules of homophobia were that if you are the receiver, that's bad and we'll ridicule you. But if you're the giver, you're the dominant. And so it doesn't actually count as homosexuality in that culture.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that.
And so, yeah, I just like playing with that dominant sexuality from not a man. That was gratifying.
It's interesting you read it as dominant sexuality.
Well, you're going to tear him open like a tiger. I felt, especially the way you introduced the poem, that there was some resentment, some actual, like, anger and wanting to destroy this person. But it sounded, like, also mixed with desire of, you know.
It's like I forget what tradition this is, but that the genital area, the penetrative is in the male, and this seems like tantra, I think. And the receptive is in the female, but in the heart, it's the opposite. Mm. Oh. So part of the concept of this poem is like the penetrative quality of the heart energy and that the capacity. And it, to me, part of why I chose it was because it feels like the woman splaying her legs, actually, because it's like there's this quality in the feminine of the ability to sort of call forth awakeness and be sort of unrelenting in the demand for integrity, and to be able to see and feel and taste any misalignment and destroy.
Yeah, so where does the destroy come in there? Because the calling forth, awakening, and destroying if you don't awaken, is that what's happening here?
Yeah, so there, you know, then you've got your seduction, but then if it's out of line, then the seduction turns into the tiger and destroys. And
that sounds like life. That sounds like what happens when you live, right? Either you figure it out or you die. Or you die in misery is kind of what happens.
Perhaps.
Andy, what do you feel?
I'm stuck on the person who said that all women want to fear, have fear in their desire.
I should clarify. I recall questioning the next day, and they said most. I recall hearing all, but I recall she said most the second time question. Which I'm not sure if I can disagree with that. I don't speak for women, but...
But I think that goes back to the objectified / brain thing. I think women want to have conquest in their desire. It's not a... Maybe it's a different kind of conquest, you know? And I think that's what you were speaking to.
Did you resonate with what... she was reading? Did that sound like your desire?
I mean, it's like desire is so different for each person too, you know? Like your desire, how you express your desire is such an interplay with the person you're desiring, you know? And some people, it's kind of a conquest, and then for people who hurt you, there's like that destructive sort of desire. And I, you know, don't mean that as just, like, vengeance, but to, like, destroy what makes them, destroy the capacity they have to hurt you and themselves. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, the Kali energy is the destroyer of everything at some level, so you can come to terms with death and destruction, but it's also the destroyer of that which is not serving in particular.
Destruction is so generative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But for me, just the poem wasn't about, it's interesting, it wasn't about sexual desire, but there is a acknowledgement of this, of the sexuality in the dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like, I want to fuck you with this rage. Mm-hmm. It's like, fuck you.
Yeah. Yeah.
With this
yeah.
rage.
Yeah.
But there's that delight, because I wasn't sure if he was really trying to sleep with them through this. Like, it just had shades of that. That makes sense to me, because that desire to destroy something, it can delight somebody in the same sort of feeling, yeah. not necessarily in the yeah. body ways,
it's
but in the same sort of... Right. In
I
that
imagine
kind of like,
it's like the male conquest.
Yeah.
It's probably the closest I could imagine to it.
Well, what's gratifying to me to hear that poem is because, so at this point in my training, I'm being told and training myself to understand that when somebody has victimized you or has hurt you, the only way out of that through liberation is to completely forgive and love them, despite mm-hmm. even whether or not they've apologized or reconciled or not. But to fully forgive and love them afterwards is the only way for you to free yourself. But your desire to destroy them like a tiger, when I'm hearing that kind of destroy, at first I'm like, phew, finally someone's allowed to say it again, because I still
yeah.
you have those desires. But also then in my head, as I'm playing with those, the feeling of wanting... Because what I found is the most, if I like picture a former bully of some sort, if I can picture them happy now, that almost like solves some of my trauma from being bullied. Just because if they're happy, then that almost makes it all better for me in a way. But
yeah.
picturing them destroyed or happy almost does the same thing.
Yeah.
I almost feel like there's a compassion in the desire for destruction.
It's like what you were saying earlier about living into the victimhood fully releases the victimhood.
Yeah.
Like, for me, like, the energy of that poem is expressing the fullness of the rage, and then you're done.
Right,
so then you can move on.
I listened to this great podcast about exactly what you're talking about. I've told you about Rob Bell. So, Rob Bell is this, like, former... He's still Christian. He's, like, a former evangelical minister who wrote a book about how hell doesn't really exist. Hell is more of a concept than an actual place, and he got, like, excommunicated, and now he has this awesome podcast, and I love it, and I've, like, seen him speak, but he did this whole series on forgiveness, and he was saying exactly what you said, like, forgiveness is just freeing that, it's like you're freeing your, by freeing the person, you're really freeing yourself, because
mm-hmm.
the person doesn't, it has no effect on the person if you hate them or not, unless you're, like, hurting them, you know. And so it's really about... But he said, in order to get there, you can't just be like, oh, I'm free you, and I love you. Like, he said it's like a wound when you get, like, a wound on your arm, and you have to, like, put it in, take a shower, and rinse all the grit out of it,
mm-hmm.
and it hurts like hell, and then so that's where you, like, write all your angry poetry. Talk about, like, destruction and stuff, and you destroy that person. Like, there's still room in forgiveness for having this, like, anger.
Well, I think that's actually a very important point, because kind of like writing a poem or just sitting with it in meditation, to forgive somebody else, first you have to forgive yourself, which means first you have to acknowledge yourself, which is the desire, is the anger, the desire to destroy, the desire to beat your bully back up. That's all going to be in there, and if you can't accept that, you're never going to forgive yourself, which is the only way you can learn how to forgive somebody else, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all part of the process. I think it's really important to remember, if we write these things down, it's a version of fully feeling them without acting on them, which is a lot like meditation. Doesn't mean we actually... I think, I don't know, I'm not going to speak for you. But at least for me, I mean, I don't actually want to go do these things.
Yeah.
It is just the acknowledgement of self
mm-hmm.
as a way of not acting. So in that way, writing angry poems, the enlightened action of not being violent.
And if we had more talk about sexual desire in spiritual tradition, maybe there would be less sexual abuse in spiritual tradition.
Yo.
I mean, to me, that's 100% parallel.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
It's like to actually make room for shadow expression and, like, feel it. And just whatever the things are we're pushing into the corner of our beings are going to show up in ugly ways, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But if you just, like, this is here, and then it becomes a healthy expression and you can move forward.
We should have, like, a spirit, like, in churches and, like, Buddhist temples and stuff, they should have, like, a spiritual day where you just, like, make the most, like, fucked up art.
Yeah.
Of, like, the, and, like, you, like, write these, like, fucking violent stories, and you're like, I'm serving Jesus with
I'm trying to get them doing the writing workshop. They're writing like nice things about each other. I'm like, come on, let's write some angry shit here, people. Let's fight. But everyone's always all happy and zazen down. I keep telling them to argue, and they don't argue.
Yeah, I got the sense that it was like not about destroying that person, but it was about like sniffing out the falsehoods and like the illusions and like destroying those. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like through writing things like that, is it, you said that you kind of, once you got it out, it was like you could move on and you weren't quite as attached to the anger for
some reason? Oh, yeah. Or, yeah. I mean, it was like super, felt real. Read it to the person and he loved it.
Oh, wow.
He like ate it up and just.
Was that great or annoying?
For him or for me?
That he loved it.
Oh, it was great.
Okay, good.
I felt received.
See, for me, I'd be like, you're supposed to hate this.
No, because he like. Ironically, he, like, took it, because it was, like, there was a way in which in this situation, like, there was valid, you know, validity yeah. for the place I was coming from, and so, for him, it was just, like, hearing me express my rage, and then he got the impact, and then the energy cleared, and then people love this poem, like, because mm-hmm. I think it speaks, and often people ask me to read this poem, and I'll be like, I don't want to drum up that energy, it's like being asked to act something out that I don't feel.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's fun and it feels good. It's like, oh yeah, that was refreshing. It was like a nice run or mm-hmm. something.
Do you feel like by him hearing it, he like got to see, it revealed something to him about his behavior that, you know?
Yeah, you know how like sometimes if you've done something that you feel like is kind of inappropriate and you don't get called out for it, there's like a niggling, unsatisfying feeling. And then when someone just says, like, hey, I've been having this experience of you and it sucks, you're mm-hmm. just, like, relief because there's just a transparency and a straightness. Mm-hmm. I think it was kind of like that, wow. moving on. And I don't know, for me, it also connects to the whole Me Too thing, and this is so politically sensitive to say, but I feel like in our relationship with victimhood, it's super healthy and important to feel all the feelings of what it's like to feel violated or... oppressed, or that there's a perpetrator who did something to you, and there are many cases where that is real and horrible and has lifetime impacts, and all of that is real. And then when we create a culture around supporting that, it runs the risk of moving into this gray area of victim identity.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then you're trapped, and then there's community of belonging around victim identity, so then you're suddenly forced to choose between moving into empowerment and free expression and playing the role you're supposed to play for the movement that's moving at a much slower pace than you as an individual maybe in your own mm-hmm. healing process. And that's a really tricky space when we're having these conversations around violation and what is it to rebalance power mm-hmm. in the aftermath of violation. And I don't have a full answer. I just look at that challenge and I see it and want us to find ways to support release and moving forward mm-hmm. while also continuing to acknowledge and change the system so these things don't happen and raise awareness and all that, but like not at the expense of people being able to identify as something other than something that happened to them once, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys want to read another poem?
Oh, sure. Do you want to go or should I go?
You go.
Okay, this one's Whimsical by Patricia Collins. Love me in a way that is boring and violent. Please cuddle me with the exact same ferocity they normally reserve for licking my ass. Cover me in the coconut oil we use for Thai food and put me all the way inside you. Eat me alive and please enjoy every bite of my American cheese body.
It's... American cheese body is like the most wonderfully disgusting line in the poem. Heard in a long time.
Especially after Thai. My chef brain goes here, like, Thai food, coconut oil, and American cheese. Like, what are you making here? That sounds terrible. You cannot put American cheese on pad Thai. That's just not going to work. Shrimp. You can't have cheese on it.
What is it that struck you when you, I feel like when you first read it, you know, you gravitated toward that one out of our submission, so.
I was probably, every wasn't clamoring for the same one. It was fun. It was just so desirous. I mean, you're just equating food with sex, just like pure, you know,
yeah.
Desire, which again, you know, as a Buddhist, like desire is all the suffering and blah, blah, blah. But, what? I believe in it. I believe in this shit.
Really?
100%. But also not, you know, because you can get your head pretty far up your own ass with that kind of stuff. Kind of like...
As long as you lick it, you're good. Right? Yes. Yes.
I forgot what I was going to say now. That was too good. Kind of like denying... I'm talking about denying something and then not seeing it. Oh, like denying your anger and then being stuck by it. If you don't fully admit your desire, you're not going to ever transcend whatever it is about desire that is. Mm, totally. And the biggest joke of Buddhism is it's never actually desire that's the problem, it's just your relationship to it. And that's actually even kind of in the line too, like why, whether or not they're having sex isn't the point. If you really understand what your desires are and know how to work with them when they come up, there's no problem in gratifying them. This is the great secret of all strict puritanical Buddhism. Is that, yeah, if you figure it out far enough, you can go back to doing everything you were doing. It's just not going to... Probably going to do it less because you have less of the desire to do it because you're not stuck by those desires. Mm-hmm. But I think there was a famous Dalai Lama quote where he's... Somebody had asked him if it was appropriate to use sex as a teaching tool. And he said, when you're at the point where you can eat a plate of shit and you can eat a...
Did he say shit?
I don't know if you use the word shit. I don't know what language he was speaking. I heard this in a third-hand quote. I don't even know if he said it. It's going to be a fake Dalai Lama quote. But when you can eat a plate of shit with the same enjoyment that you can eat a, whatever you like, a pizza. Oh, he didn't say pizza. Then you can use sex as a teaching tool. Basically, you know, implying that, you know, the awakened mind can do these things in the same light. And but then you can eat the cheeseburger. Probably less likely to eat it as often, but you can still do it without it being a hindrance or a problem. You
know? And then there's Rumi, the longing for God is God.
Mm. Mm. Oh, that's like desire itself as...
Is,
do you say that as an argument to Buddha's argument?
It's
or?
Just sort of the anti-Zen statement. I mean, eventually all paths lead to the same place, but you have a different starting point. You've got the sort of tantric, roomy,
yeah.
ecstatic orientation of moving through desire to truth versus... mastering your relationship with desire is a path to truth.
What's funny is I hear Rumi's quote is exactly my Zen practice.
Yeah.
Because if the... Say the quote again.
The longing for God is God.
If you know the longing for God is God, then you don't have to go, let's say cheeseburger's your God at that moment. You really want a fucking cheeseburger. Effing. You don't need to go get the cheeseburger because the longing for it was good enough. So if I'm sitting in Zazen watching my desires, I'm perfectly content having my desires. I don't have the need to go... satiate them.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Are we putting all desire on the same level, though? Like, desire for love and sex is different than desire for heroin or cigarettes, don't you think?
No.
I don't either.
Mm-mm.
Hmm. You don't think there's, like, a healthy desire?
I think there's one desire in the universe and we all misconfuse it into a million different fractured ways. I think the one desire in the universe that we all share is to fully know ourselves, which is, you can also say, is ultimate boundless love. You can say it's connection with the world around you. I think the fundamental mistake of being human is that we think we're separate from the world around us, and that separation causes all of the suffering we feel. So all we're ever trying to do is just feel that completeness. When we do things that feel pleasurable, it's easier to connect to what we're doing. Therefore, we feel more connected, so therefore it's satiating for the moment. But if I desire a cigarette, and I have one, then I fully enjoy the moment of having a cigarette, maybe for a minute, so I feel connected to the world. But then I'm saying, but I don't want to not smoke, and so I'm cutting myself off from the experience of not smoking, which cut myself off from experience more. I don't know if that made any sense.
So it's like the sense that we have that we're separate leads us to want to do things that make us feel non-separate.
Right. Like fall in love, or have sex,
right.
Or eat a cheeseburger.
But, like, smoking is inherently bad for you, and the desire for it is, like, one thing, but then, like, sex is not inherently bad for you. It's not. It's good for you in a lot of senses. Like, there's the shadow side to sex, obviously, but... It's not pure shadow side. So it's like, how do you put all desire on the same spectrum?
Oh, I guess I'm not concerned. When I'm thinking about pursuing ultimate truth, my bodily health doesn't really my first. That's probably a mistake on my part.
This is the Thich Nhat Hanh training, I think.
My training is to not separate because I'm looking at my relationship to experience.
Uh-huh.
And my relationship to experience of wanting sex in a lot of ways that I might want it is very similar to wanting a cigarette. It's a compulsion designed to satiate a quick desire that has no larger relevance to meaning.
So you're saying that some objects of desire are better for you than others, but you're saying that the desire, the engine behind the desire itself is kind of like the same.
She's like orienting to bodily health.
Bodily or spiritual health.
She's having a practical talk, I'm having a spiritual talk.
I mean, it's like, okay, because I feel like I'm thinking of all my desires, and it's like, I'll have a desire to go make art, and then some nights I have a desire to smoke a cigarette, and it's like the practiced person in me and the self-aware person, and the more I meditate and love myself, I'm going to acknowledge the two desires, but I'm going to act on the desire to make art and try not to act on the desire to smoke a cigarette.
And I'm kind of with you. My training is more, I think love's a great example, because you can fall in love compulsively just because you feel kind of needy and clingy, and you can fall in love because it's part of something that kind of provides more meaning and kind of actually does bring you closer to feeling full with your life and experience. But my practice is, and that's a valid practice, it's many people's practice, is to try not to do the bad one and try to do the good one. Makes perfect sense. I get why people think that's a good idea. Totally get it. But my practice is more to, because that mind of picking and choosing, I also see cuts me off.
Mm-hmm.
Of saying cigarette desire is bad, cuts me off from the experience of cigarette desire.
Maybe.
So it cuts me off from aspects of myself. So my practice is more just to watch them all and then do what naturally occurs.
But I'm on the same page with you. Cigarette desire is not bad. Acting on the cigarette desire is bad.
In my experience, trying not to smoke a cigarette will make me smoke a cigarette faster than anything else in the universe.
But actually, so that's why I like Patricia's poem.
Yeah, oh yeah, we were talking about this great poem about
American cheese body.
Because love is so wholesome and it's ultimate meaningful and good for you in a way that is boring and violent. Like, I feel like it's all in there. It's like it's putting all the desires together and embracing them in a way that just feels like wrong and right at the same time. I feel like that's what my practice feels like. It's all the wrong, all the right, and all the ultimate meaning all put together in one little ball, and none of them exist without each other.
It's like I want to open a tea house called Virtue and Vice that also serves whiskey.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like this good and bad distinction is at some level ridiculous, and at other levels totally valid.
Yeah, a little helpful, a little bit of hindrance.
There was some other line in there I wanted, that I forgot. Let me look at that again. I think you guys there's sort of this unifying theme too of like objectification and wanting to be objectified. Like this person like wants to be like food. You know? Like
I want to be destroyed.
I want to be destroyed. Yeah.
Wants a tiger to come just tear it apart.
Yeah. It's like all this sort of, that's what I was going to say.
And then there's the other moment where she's like, can we transform the intensity, the sexual intensity that we have that's often kind of like violent into cuddling? I thought that was interesting too. Does somebody want to read the final poem that we have? I know we're...
Yeah, are you into it?
Okay. So I did not choose this poem, and I think it's very appropriate now because I was like so puritanical earlier in our conversation. So this was chosen by...
Ariel.
Okay. But she can't be here tonight. Okay. So this is called Hibiscus in the Bedroom by Keith Mark Gabori. Excuse me if I'm butchering your name. My penis split open into a blooming hibiscus as I twisted about on our matrimony mattress. Sleeping in granite skin, your chest heaved up and down as four foreign petals extended themselves like a gymnast vaulting through Olympic air. But my dick never won a gold medal in swimming or backflips of conception to your egg, dissolving through baby hungry fingers. With a knock on the door, I sprang to the source, greeting a honeybee buzzing to the nectar. I secreted in our common land of pollination. When you awoke and tossed an infidelity shot like a dart, I offered my hibiscus in the vein of an orphan standing in the rain.
There's a lot going on there.
Yeah. I feel like we always forget to remember that sex is about making babies. Like,
yeah.
We talk about sex culture a lot these days, but we always forget it used to have a purpose.
But here we're back into the concept of, like, the, like, sacred genitalia and, like, the creation of the world.
How'd you feel reading that poem?
Well, I mean, it's funny. I think it's just, like, you see penis in the first line of a poem and you're like, okay, this is, like, establishing what this is about. But obviously there's so much more to it than that. But it's funny to round out the conversation about conception after, you know, me rolling my eyes at the nun saying that's where every Buddha, monk, and nun came from. So
I have no problem with that theme being central to human art for all time, because it's a thing we're into, you know. It's part of the magic and mystery and beauty of the human experience, and so of course it comes out through art, left, right, and center, you know.
No, I guess my annoyance with it is more of just having that, looking at it very, like, one-dimensionally, like, women are, like, because women have babies, there's something special, like, that they're more sacred or more divine, or, like, I get really sick of that.
Did you feel like this poem did I hear it wrong, or was he making the penis kind of like that, too?
Yeah, no, I think he is, but, like, let me see, it's talking more about conception and like, a less...
I like his insecurity around his penis's performance towards making babies.
Yeah. But I like it because it's, like, they're both trying to, I think.
But I didn't understand the infidelity.
Yeah.
Yeah, the shot of infidelity and the knock on the door thing that was a little confusing to me. And I was wondering, like, was the knock on the door representing somebody else that came in and kind of caused the woman to...
And maybe somebody else gave the woman a baby, or maybe the infidelity was that they are having trouble conceiving. I wasn't quite sure how to read that line.
Either way, it's distractions in the process, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Something's not working.
And then the orphan at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What was the orphan part again?
Like a dart, I offered my hibiscus in the vein of an orphan standing in the rain. Well, an orphan is someone who has no parents, and these are two people trying to be parents.
The other thing that comes up for me is just the vulnerability of the male aspect of sex, and I appreciate
mm-hmm.
that being
mm-hmm.
brought out. I mean,
yeah.
And yeah, it really is a two-way street vulnerability-wise. We just often don't perceive it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, characterizing the penis as a flower was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great way to round out this whole podcast.
Yes, and.
Yeah.
Both and.
Yeah.
Cigarettes and pistachios.
Dave, do you have any announcements or anything?
We have a Patreon, right? On
yes.
this webpage? On this website,
yes.
There's a Patreon. If you want to go to it and help support what we're doing. Some of it goes to help support the Zen Center and the work with the koans, and also just keeping these kind of things going. So,
yeah, and if you become a supporter, we're going to put exclusive content on our Patreon. So,
yeah. Also, please submit your poems. We're going to be doing so every episode now. We're going to have a story posted in advance, and we will take submissions on a poem that relates to that story in any way, shape, or form that you feel like it might. If you want to tell us how you think it does, feel more than free. You don't have to, and we might ignore what you said anyway because we don't care, but we actually do care. It'll always be interesting. yeah, so thanks for listening.